Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. I'm Jeff Tiberi. On this edition of the podcast, we're talking presidential health, gubernatorial history in North Carolina, and even some millennial attitudes and really whatever else might emerge during the conversation. Here to make some sense of those topics and share other election season musings is Chris Cooper, a professor and department head of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina, that's in Cullowhee. He joins me from the studios of WCQS in downtown Asheville. Hello, Chris.
Hey, it's great to talk to you, Jeff.
Thanks for being here. So we're taping this on a Monday afternoon, or on Monday afternoon, we should note that. Let's begin nationally. Yesterday, Hillary Clinton left the 9/11 memorial in New York City, appearing visibly fatigued. Her aides said yesterday afternoon that the Democratic nominee had been diagnosed with pneumonia on Friday. Earlier today, Donald Trump was on Fox News. He said, I just hope she gets well and gets back on the trail, and we'll be seeing her at this debate. They say pneumonia on Friday, but she was coughing very, very badly a week ago, and even before that, if you remember. It's very interesting to see what's going on, close quote. That was Trump responding to Clinton and her illness that had been diagnosed on Friday. We, as the public, saw it over the weekend. Chris, what do you make of all this?
Not too much on the health front, right? I mean, you've got a 68-year-old candidate. You've got a 70-year-old candidate. They're both running horrible schedules. They're shaking hands. They're kissing babies. They're going to get sick. So I don't think for Hillary Clinton it's really so much, kind of a matter of the health itself. I think the problem is this perception that she's not honest. The Clintons in general, frankly, aren't honest and aren't forthright with the press and with the public. And so I think that's the sort of the media combating that she needs to do is to let folks know that she is going to be more open and to not let Trump kind of play this private Clinton card. So, you know, I think this is kind of the nightmare for a candidate, right? When something goes wrong that tends to play into this larger narrative that you're trying to fight against. And I think that's the problem that Hillary Clinton's going to face.
Right, right. There have been other presidential nominees over the last two decades. Bob Dole and John McCain are the first two that come to mind. Both Republican nominees who were in their 70s, if memory serves, when they were, you know, running for the White House on that final two-person ticket. Are there other instances in political history when health has mattered in this race? I mean, I think of FDR, I think of McCain. Is it just chatter? Or has it ever really amounted to, you know, a significant influence on the outcomes?
I think most of the time these kinds of things don't kind of matter in the real electoral outcome, right? Most sort of game changers don't really end up changing the game all that much. And so I'd say health is kind of one of those. FDR is probably a good example where it mattered. I think with Reagan, certainly health was important. So I think from a policymaking perspective, perhaps it is important. From an electoral outcome, again, I think it's less about whether she's got pneumonia or not and more about did it take her too long to say she had pneumonia and sort of playing into this larger fear. It's the same thing that the email plays into, the idea that people think that the Clintons think that they're above the law. Now, whether that's true or not, it's obviously a totally different question, but I think that is the perception game that she's having to battle.
All right. You, as a political scientist, at this point, a little bit less than 2 months before the general election, give me a sense, what are you reading daily? What are you looking at? What are you monitoring? What for you is important in terms of digesting?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, I listen to a lot of podcasts like this one, to be honest. My lawn's pretty big. It takes me a long time to mow it, and I catch up on a lot of podcasts then. I try to look at polling data, but I try to not look at individual polls. I'm not saying that I never do, but the idea is to read kind of the averages of polls, and there's a lot of different sources for this. Real Clear Politics does one. 538.com, of course, does one. And there's more than you can count at this point. So no matter your sort of political persuasion, you can find them. I read Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia does kind of a weekly thing called Sabato's Crystal Ball. And I don't love the name, but I do love the content. There's a fellow at Bloomberg, Bernstein is his last name, I believe. And he does a great little sort of wrap up in the morning There's also a couple of political science blogs that I read. The Monkey Cage, which is hosted by the Washington Post, is a great place to learn about what real political science research can tell us about current politics. And of course, I try to follow, you know, WRAL and some of the different statewide sources as well.
Not to send our listeners too many different places and never coming back to us, but no, that's an interesting.
It was implied. It was an implied comeback.
No, I don't know. I follow many of those same outlets as well, and I think it's important to just be checking in different mediums, different, I guess, regions outside of North Carolina. Yeah. And I'm just firing from the hip here. Are there any other states that are particularly intriguing, or areas, or referenda, or issues elsewhere that are, capturing your attention right now?
You know, I think all the battleground states, or the ones that we perceive as being battleground states, are interesting. I mean, I try to follow a little bit what's going on in Pennsylvania. I try to follow what's going on in Ohio. I certainly try to follow what's going on in Florida. I kind of wonder if Virginia is going to be closer than other folks think. I sort of watch Georgia and South Carolina as really interesting cases for how unusual this election is, right? There's no world in which a Democratic candidate should have any shot in South Carolina or Georgia. So, we're getting these sort of polling updates that say, gee, maybe Clinton has a chance in South Carolina or has a chance in Georgia. I don't believe that's true, but the fact that people are saying it says, I need to pay attention to these states. We know that states don't tend to sort of move independently. They tend to move in these kind of bigger swings. So as goes South Carolina, or as goes Georgia, or as goes Virginia, so too, in some ways, goes North Carolina.
All right, what about, I've read a couple of things in recent weeks about the Midwest, and that being one pathway to the White House for Donald Trump, talking about Michigan, if he could carry Wisconsin. What's your feeling, your gut on those?
You know, I think obviously these blue-collar states like Michigan, like Pennsylvania, like Wisconsin to some degree are really important for Donald Trump. They seem like the kind of place where he would tend to do particularly well. They're states that have gone back and forth. They've had Republican governors. At the same time, he's not doing as well in those places as we would expect he would. I think if there was a different Republican candidate, those states would be a lot closer than they currently are.
Okay. Chris Cooper is chatting with us about politics. He's currently sitting in a studio somewhere in downtown Asheville at WCQS. This is the WNC Politics Podcast. I want to transition a little bit and chat about the governor's race, and also, I guess I would call it a loose research study that we did. I looked at governors of North Carolina going back 100 years, which amounts to 20 governors, and ran some numbers on them, primarily was trying to look at the governor's educational backgrounds and occupation. There were several things that stood out to me, but before I jade you one way or the other or steer you down a particular path, I sent you some of that information. Mm-hmm. What did you make of it? What was interesting or not interesting or whatever?
You know that there's not a lot of clear patterns, right? Sort of one thing I took from it, it's really interesting to look at it all in one place and all in one table. And I didn't see, it's not like North Carolina tends to go for a certain type of governor or a governor that has a certain sort of set of characteristics. There's no checklist for being a North Carolina governor. I think what we see is a state that tends to swing the way the country, and certainly the South swings. Obviously, we've seen a shift in who's our governor from the time where it was a solidly Democratic South to a two-party South to what some folks might argue is a one-party Republican South again. Not kind of one thing over time, but more a reflection of a kind of a larger national and regional political trends.
Sure. Okay. A couple of things for listeners to chew on. Of the last 20 governors in the state, again, going back to 1917, 14 of them were attorneys or earned law degrees. 13 of them were born in North Carolina. 5 of them went to UNC for undergraduate work. 8 of them went to UNC Chapel Hill for their law degrees. I thought it was kind of interesting. 6 of 7 governors, a string of 6 out of 7 between 1949 and 1973, served in the military. But all governors before that and after that didn't serve in the armed forces, at least from the research I did. One thing that did stand out to me, I want you to tell me why it doesn't matter or why I shouldn't be surprised. None of the last 20 governors of North Carolina earned an MBA.
You know, it is kind of interesting, but I think we're selecting on sort of one person. I mean, I think an MBA could be a good path. I think law has traditionally been thought of as the kind of path into politics. And if some of these governors obviously used to work in the state legislature, and we know the state legislature has been dominated overwhelmingly by lawyers and farmers, really, the early 1900s and becoming lawyers later. So I think maybe it's a sort of a bigger sign about the fact that our governors tend to be pulled from folks who've been in politics for a long time, and they haven't spent quite as much time in the business world as they have the political world. Some folks might argue that's good. Some folks might argue that's bad. So I wouldn't preclude an MBA in the future, but I think law will continue to be the sort of classic path into politics.
Okay. There are 12 gubernatorial races in the country this year, only one in the Southeast, that being North Carolina. From my vantage point, I'm clearly biased here, but this has got to be the most interesting governor's race taking place anywhere.
And I am biased as well, and I will add to the chorus of bias and say, yes, I think it is the most interesting race. I think it's the most competitive race. I think North Carolina has been sort of nationalized in the last 5 years in really interesting ways. I mean, we've got a state that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal traded competing editorials about the future of our state. I mean, that's pretty unusual. We're not exactly in the New York media market. So clearly we are a national story. HB2 is, of course, the elephant in the room, has become representative of this broader class of laws. I think what we've seen with redistricting, I think what we've seen with voter ID, North Carolina is a national story now. And so you take what is a very interesting race to start with, two sitting office holders, and then you add to it a swing state, and then you add to it a swing state that's been in the national media arguably as much as any other state in the country.
Right.
And you got either something fascinating or a big mess, depending on your perspective.
Right. So I'm interested from your perspective how you expect or perhaps think he should pivot, right? So the governor, if we look at parts of his track record, parts of his resume over the last 4 years, there are things to run on, right? There's lower unemployment. The taxes are lower. How much teacher pay has increased is certainly up for debate, but teacher pay has increased. And then, you know, over on this other side, this other corner, is the issue of House Bill 2, some of the social things that have social issues that have come out of the General Assembly, the voting law as one that certainly emerges to the top of mind. And from the governor's perspective, from his campaign, how do you expect him and his aides and his people to try to refocus this on the almost the unequivocal positives that have come out of the last 4 years? Or do you not expect them to do that?
I expect that they will. I mean, I think the smart move here for the governor is to talk about the economy. I mean, we know that in a normal election cycle, now granted this may not be normal, but in a normal election cycle, the economy is sort of the single most important issue. I think he can try to talk about things like teacher pay, but as you point out, fairly or not, it's a contested issue. And if you add to that, that voters tend to trust Democrats more than Republicans on issues around education. We talk about issue ownership sometimes, and I think the Democrats kind of own this issue of education. Conversely, though, I think the Republicans sort of own the issue of the economy. And so I would expect McCrory to continue to talk about the economy, to continue to talk about what's sort of about tax rates, about sort of growth in the economy. The HB2 thing is fascinating. He's going to be made to talk about it. I would imagine he's going to want to talk about it as little as possible on his own.
But doesn't it seem like he's talking about it a decent amount? It doesn't seem like he's ducking that one. We had this ad that came out last week.
It is surprising to me that he hasn't. So I guess really I'm sort of answering what I would expect would happen. And you're absolutely right. The last week he has zigged when I thought he would zag, I guess. He has spent more time talking about HB2. I wonder if that's because Trump is setting such an unusual place at the top of the ticket that he's got to find a way to get the Republicans on his side, say, hey, I'm still a real Republican. You're still a real Republican. You need to vote for me. So it's possible that he is trying to sort of shore up his base at a time where normally we would think that's unnecessary, right? At this point in the election, you expect, of course, Republicans are going to vote for Republican incumbent governor. Come on.
Right.
And maybe we're not seeing that right now.
I'm interested in hearing a pulse or a snapshot of what your students are talking about or caring about or asking you about. I'm presuming here that most of your students are between 18 and 22, and you're teaching a couple of political science courses and a public affairs course. Tell me a little bit about what you've got this fall and how the students are interpreting it.
Yeah, so I've got two courses this fall. One is a parties, campaigns, and elections class. That's probably the one you care the most about. I also teach a graduate public affairs administration class. Those are two pretty different populations of students. So the public affairs class, they're graduate students. They tend to work in the nonprofit sector. They tend to work in the public sector. And they tend to live in the city of Asheville or darn close. And so they certainly tend to lean left as a rule. My undergraduate students are pretty much right down the middle. So in the campaigns and elections class, we've already had great discussions, as you would imagine, around Trump. And then when they get sick of that, we talk some about Trump. And so they are certainly split. And the Western Carolina University College Republicans did come out in support of Trump, in strong support of Trump, unlike some of these college Republican groups throughout the system and throughout the country. So they have been supporting Trump. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about. We're trying to figure out to what degree is Trump indicative of just kind of a weird one-off candidate, or is this a new paradigm in understanding political parties? I tend to think it's not. I tend to think Trump is an unusual candidate who's a result of a 17-person overcrowded field where the Republican Party didn't coordinate the way they should have, but my students have some smart counterarguments. One reason I really like working at Western, actually, is we tend to be pretty split. We did a poll a few years ago across a few different battleground states, and so I ended up getting the data from lots of different schools throughout the state of North Carolina. And as you can imagine, there were schools on the left, like UNC, and there were schools on the right, like Wingate, and WCU was sort of smack in the middle. We had about 52% of our students who had supported the Democratic candidate and about 48 who had supported the Republican candidate. So it's a fun place to teach in that way.
All right. So obviously that poll did not incorporate Ralph Nader or whoever the third party candidate would have been. Right. And maybe it was Gary Johnson 4 years ago. And I'm probably showing some of my cards here in that I'm also a millennial. On the different end of the millennial decades than presumably many of your students.
Mm-hmm.
Trump and Clinton are the most disliked major party candidates that I believe we've seen in American political history. What's the conversation, if any, around Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, who isn't going to be on the ballot in North Carolina this fall?
Right. Yeah, so the Gary Johnson piece has definitely sparked some more conversation. We actually just the other day had a conversation about third parties and the degree to which they don't win. And I think I probably upset a couple of students because I kind of marched through the sort of folks we think of as successful third party candidates. You know, your Ralph Naders, your Ross Perot's, even to some degree your George Wallace's, right? These folks at least got some sizable proportion of the popular vote and in a couple of cases got a few electoral college votes. But the big takeaway, in my mind anyway, is that unless we change the structure of the way people are elected, and yes, that's a boring sentence, but I think it matters, we're going to end up with a two-party system. So my students seem to be very frustrated. They tend to like, last week notwithstanding, Gary Johnson and what he stands for and the fact that he's advocating something outside of the two-party system. And I think they're frustrated with the sort of fact that that's going to be incredibly difficult without some major structural change in the United States.
Where is Aleppo? Where is Kulawi? I mean, these are similar kinds of questions, right?
They're on everybody's mind. I always tell people, you know, it's west of Asheville, sort of north of Greenville. You know, we're kind of out there.
Right.
I think this sort of you raised, and I'll be happy to recut it if you want to, the sort of the question about media consumption habits and kind of where I'm reading and where I'm trying to find news. And I find that really interesting with my students today. We know that people tend to have sort of source credibility issues, right? So if they trust WUNC, then you tell them a piece of information, they're going to tend to believe that more than if it comes from another source. And so the degree to which our students tend to lock into a very few news sources is interesting to me and is a pattern that I try mostly unsuccessfully to break. And I think if you think about the way that their Facebook feeds, of course, and their Twitter feeds, and if there's such thing as a Snapchat feed, reinforce these preconceived political ideas that folks have. I really notice that with my students, and that's frankly a little bit of a concern.
What haven't we discussed that is top of mind for you right now? I don't know, experiments you're
sure.
trying on your students, political conversations you're having, whatever. What haven't we discussed?
A few things that just sort of pop to mind. Take whatever's interesting to you. I mean, one is on the way here, I walked by a Donald Trump rally, right? So today, Donald Trump is going to be in Asheville. He's, I believe, leaving Baltimore, if I remember right, and sort of heading his way towards Asheville. And as I walked by what we used to call the Civic Center here in Asheville, which we now call, I believe, the Cellular Center, I saw six protesters, and I saw about 300 Trump supporters. And so I think that's obviously a very interesting thing going on. And I think it illustrates, a lot of folks have asked me, why Asheville? I even got a call from France, believe it or not, asking me kind of why Asheville? What the heck's going on? And I think part of that is a sort of a feature of the American Electoral College system. We take it for granted that candidates should spend time and money in battleground states, and that is what they're incentivized to do. But within a state, a vote in Raleigh and a vote in Asheville are worth the exact same. So if they can get two folks to convert here, they're worth the same as the ones in Charlotte. And I think it also points out, kind of for folks interested in state politics, how different Asheville is than the rest of Western North Carolina. Asheville really is sort of a dot of blue and a fairly red region. Jackson County, where Western Carolina University is, has gone blue sometimes. But generally speaking, Asheville is the exception and not the rule of Western North Carolina politics.
Interesting. All right, Chris, we will leave it there. That was Chris Cooper, a professor of political science and public affairs. He's the department head at Western Carolina in Cullowhee. He spoke with us from the studios of WCQS in downtown Asheville. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
All right, that will do it for this episode of the WUNC Politics Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Google Play, whatever app you use, and check out other political stories from our reporters during the week on WUNC, the State of Things, and WUNC.org. Have a good day. We'll talk to you soon.